You're listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. If you're interested in listening at home on your PC, iPhone, or BlackBerry, where this station streams live on the internet, please visit www.wsps.sps.edu or visit my website at radioghost.com for the link. I bolted up from the chair and pressed myself to the wall. After a moment's close scrutiny to see if my movement had been detected, I leaned out the empty door space, peering down the length of the house, where I saw the heart-pounding figure of a man kicking a shovel into the soil. There were two small wooden boxes in the grass at his feet, and on top of one of these lay a flashlight, which sent a weak spray of light at the targeted excavation. The man dug for a while, and then sat down on his knees, and thereupon shifted the two boxes into the hole. He pressed them down, and then levelled his arm through the hill of soil, and covered them. He patted the loose soil down, and then stood and stomped across the little plot, and then scuffed some leaves across the top, as though returning the aggravated location to a somewhat natural look. He lifted up his shovel and flashlight and came slowly toward the house. I flattened against the interior wall, my heart in four furies as to what might happen next. The flashlight pierced through the front door and painted wildly over the walls. The man stepped up on the jamb and balanced there, then carved the silver light along the walls, over the now empty chair, to the crate, where a few crackers and the half-eaten sandwich lay. I winced especially, seeing the old silver flask standing open next to the piece of sandwich. The man took one step in and reached for the crackers. He pressed them down, testing their freshness. He then grabbed the sandwich and smelled it and squeezed the soft bread. Food left behind, even fresh food, might indicate a recent visitor. But the flask was not something to be left behind. He brought the flask to his nose and sniffed it. Then he rotated it around until he could see the three ornate initials carved on the front side. And then he put the flask down and backed away. "Hope that does it for you, Dad," Seamus Dunn's quiet voice spoke. His flashlight hovered around a last moment before swinging away. I listened to the departing footsteps and then stepped to the door to watch Seamus walking away down the dark path toward his home. Slowly, so quietly and reluctantly, I drifted toward the side yard where Seamus had buried his boxes. I knelt in the dirt and brushed aside the leaves. My hands went into the dirt. It was so soft and easy, and I could already feel the corner of one of the boxes. But I stopped to turn up the headlamp, when in the fresh illumination, my eye caught sight of these dark, toppling old boulders in a kind of pattern through the woods. I evaluated these briefly before sitting back, defeated. I pushed the little feature of dirt I'd managed back into place, scattered some leaves, and then brushed my hands free of the dirt. I could not overlook this. These rocks stopped me, for I was not just sitting in a side yard, but in the Dunn family cemetery. The stones, 9 of them, engraved with arrival and departure dates, was scattered between the saplings in the woods here. The nearest stone belonged to Seamus's father, Thomas Wentworth Dunn, born 1807, died 1989. So a family plot straddling the old Dunn homestead. I could not trespass here, in this most sacred spot, where Seamus looked after his family and kept such mysterious boxes, and where presumably he and his wife Maggie would someday, shortly be. I went back inside to get the flask. I had no idea why Seamus had not gone searching the house for the flask's owner. But then I lifted it, took a small sip, and then looked at the flowery initials of the previous owner, T.W.D. Not only had I gotten the headlamp and the parade outfit from the estate sale, I'd also gotten myself a useful flask.
Time will slow you down. If you're lucky, a chance to be ground into the earth. The wind playing with your sense before you leave this land. Impatience kills good chance.
I was then heading to the Dunn's farmhouse, by way of the upper path, rather than across the McCaw Meadows, as another fragment of my dream included a view from the top of the bald ridge. Through the spaces in the trees, as I rose, I could see the white tops of the assembled tents. There were trucks in the field, and men still working in the darkness, racing against time, as was the usual case. There was the occasional sound of mallets striking iron stakes and of truck doors shutting hard. The path grew wider as I approached the bald ridge. The white rocks glowed bluish in the moonlight. I stepped carefree out onto the slab, but came to a quick halt when I saw Seamus Dunn standing 20 yards ahead and somewhat higher up on the ledge. I backed slowly into the woods, extinguishing the flame and the lamp, as Seamus turned and looked down at the meadows, as though seeking a reference point. He surveyed and then crossed along the rocks, scanning for something, as though he'd lost his watch, and then he glanced higher, and with some effort, using his hands in places, began to rise up the ledges. Because of our uncomfortable close call at the house, it seemed an unpleasant prospect to now meet up with him here. So when he disappeared behind some rocks, I slipped out over the ridge and crossed to the path on the far side. I descended quickly down the trail, which spills out and dies about 30 yards from the Dunn's farmhouse. I drew past the house and then stopped in a corner of the field. As the moon was up and bright, I removed the headlamp and slipped it into my pocket as the last of the men packed up their things. It was probably 9 o'clock or so.
"Sherwin, come over."
The soft voice of Maggie Dunn reached for me. I turned round. She beckoned me from the porch. I waved and moved with some reluctance toward her.
"See Seamus up there?"
she asked lightly. "I should think about some climbing rope for that one," I said, as cheerfully as I could.
"He's half goat," she said, unconcerned. "Come sit. They've got the tents up. It's so nice they're done. Last year they were here till midnight. So now, guess who saw a ghost last night?"
"Maggie,"
and Seamus for that matter, were all the time coming at you with this sort of rhetoric, where you were never lost for the answer. You? I guessed. Me? Maggie said, nodding and smiling happily. Can you believe it? I don't even believe in ghosts. Still don't. Is that possible? Hard to undo a lifetime of thinking one way about it. The demon of Lemon, was it? I wondered, half joking. Oh, I know you don't believe it, she said. That's fine. I don't either. But let me tell you. Guess who also had a late-night visitor in addition last night? You? I guessed again. About midnight. I heard something scratching around on the porch, like someone's dropping off their laundry like the old days. But since we retired, we don't get those noises anymore, thank God. But last night, I swear, someone's out there. Who is it, Seamus? I said. Who doesn't know we're retired? Seamus grumbled. He wouldn't even wake up, so I peek out the window, and I don't see anything. And then, for extra safety, I go have a peek up the bald ridge. It's just a bad habit when I get up for a scare, because of the history, because who knows? But I look last night, and don't I see the vaguest something or other up there? So I call out to Seamus, come look, come look. And he's so slow to come that he barely gets a glimpse of my ghost. And then he, who only had this tiny glimpse, says, that's no ghost, it's a man in his undies. And he heads right back to sleep, as though that's what we always have on the cliff, an underwear man on the ridge. So I go to bed mad. Next morning, I'm giving him the silent treatment. And then all of a sudden, guess who starts bellowing, 'cause he found an old black suit and some old shoes on the porch? Seamus, I guessed. Like we're not retired 10 years already, someone leaving their laundry for us, but I'm still giving him the silent treatment. And then he's calling for me, but I won't budge. And then he finds me and he says in a hush, it's the suit I buried Dad in, and the shoes too, Maggie. And oh my, did our eyes go starry bright. That was my father last night that we saw on the ridge, Seamus says, bringing us his graveyard clothes to wash and shoes to mend. An uncomfortable heat was rising at my collar. I see, I said. And how will Seamus's father come to fetch these clothes? Not only was I deeply discomforted by the story, I was also trying to find some way that my parade outfit could return to my possession. Well, he buried the suit and shoes up at the gravesite, Maggie said, matter of fact, as though this is what anyone would do. Good thinking, I said. And now he's up on the high ledge there, with a cheese sandwich and some crackers. I see, I said. And what would be the point of that? Seamus couldn't stand his father, if you remember. You met him, I think. A mean old bully, terrible, bossy man. Seamus wouldn't talk to him at the end, and there was this sort of rift. But still, we had to take care of him, family and everything, which means food and care. So Seamus would bring over meals and things. So hard on him, for the abuse he'd get every time. And the night before his father died, he ordered Seamus to bring him up supper, and Seamus didn't, for spite, to show that that's not how he should be treated. And then the old man died. And there was this black guilt that came to Seamus, so deep and black, this pain in him, which he couldn't even talk about. So what it is now is to get that closure around it. That's what it is now. Closure is what's happening for Seamus, with the return of old Thomas Wentworth Dunn. Maggie was pleased. She'd come to the word closure that described it. This is the piece of their mutual forgiveness. Him to his father to him, she said, under her breath, as though it was not really a part of the story or something she wished to share. That's what Seamus says of it anyway, that this is the piece of their forgiveness. I had had a steadily and complexly growing sense of distress. I was bothered deeply by the treacherous results of my sleepwalking. I had obviously come to the Duns, left my clothing for their tending, gone up onto the Bald Ridge, in my underclothes, where the Duns had mistaken me for a ghost, for the ghost of Thomas Wentworth Dunn. Yet at the same time, I wanted my suit back, my shoes. I wanted to instantly erase this whole ghost business, show or tell them that it was me. But how? I knew only that it was wrong, however accidentally, through the agency of a semi-conscious state, to have misled them into thinking that Thomas Wentworth Dunn was walking around looking to make peace with his son and have cheese sandwiches and have his shoes cobbled and his suit cleaned. I should go, I said. My hands were flush. The miner's lamp and the flask were guilty lumps in my pockets. You'll come tomorrow? Maggie asked. Wouldn't miss it. My voice quavered with what was almost verging now on shame. Hello to Seamus for me, I muffled quietly. I tipped my head and waved awkwardly and started down the porch stairs. The night rolled with itself, the black of space, the point of star, the loose light edges of the crescent moon. I couldn't see him, but I could hear Seamus scrambling over the ledges above, in the knocking of the rocks and the small avalanches, positioning the awful cheese sandwich as a token symbol, of his side anyway, of the mutual forgiveness. At home, I sat collapsed and lowly in my broken thought streams. I had a drink from Thomas Wentworth Dunn's flask, and then another, all the while faintly wondering how to recover my parade outfit from the Dunn family cemetery without becoming the grave robber that I must for doing so. Could I just fetch it back? Wear it, even? Maybe wait a year or two? My eyes began to close. If I wore a strange colored shirt, if I changed the laces of the shoes, if my bow tie was phosphorescent, spectacular, striking, enormous. My thoughts dimmed around an imagined exchange of Maggie and Seamus greeting me on their porch, not at all noticing that I was wearing the outfit of the long-dead man, of the freshly laundered, freshly buried suit and cobbled shoes, the headlamp glowing at my forehead, handing the flask to Seamus, finding my own peace and closure in this rift my sleepwalking self had fashioned for me to seal. The sense that I could look inside and see the steep, dark pit of my enormous appetite. I went into the living room. It was evening yet again, I supposed. There was a dim crackling of light through the windows. I lit the headlamp and drew the straps below my chin, and in the rosy light I now noticed the small, peg-like stairs bolted to the wall of my cabin,
I had almost completely forgotten about the storage loft on the second level. The steps were so thin and small that years could pass without my thinking of them. I set my foot on the bottom peg and tested the second. There was no railing, and these steps were just wide enough for a single foot. I remembered happily, as I rose up the pegs, that I kept my holiday snacks up there in the loft, set out on a waiting arrangement of plates. I moved as quickly as I could up the tiny stairs, and I smiled as I stepped into the familiar, soft loam of the loft. It's so easy to forget that the floor up there is made of dirt. I had plans to put in a garden, but no one could quite tell me the best kind of indoors crop for a second level. I knelt down into the dirt and began to dig. I'd been keeping my parade outfit buried in the earth for many years now. It's the best way to make an old outfit last. I skivvied out the wooden boxes, gratified to find things as I'd hoped. The dark wool jacket and pants were actually improved by this special keeping. I drew on the pants and coat and tied the shoes, and then gazed upward at the toppled pile of my storage. It occurred to me that I might do a bit of due diligence and take the parade outfit for a trial run, make sure things were holding together. But I was still hungry, and recalled that my snacks were actually further up in the small second loft area. So I began to climb up into the pile, stepping over the old boxes of clothes, the hard shapes of this and that. I could smell the hot sweet cider wafting down from my snack area. I loved that I maintained this snack section for myself. There was a faint smoke now, too, of hamburgers and a rising warm wind of cotton candy. I looked back down into the distance below me. I could see the smooth white tents and the glorious lights of the festival. The cold night made the horses' breath shoot out in tendrils of smoke as they led the trains of hay-spilling wagons round the circumference of the field. I reached upward and took hold of the ledge and drew myself to the very highest place in the cabin, a dark little nook up below the stars. I sat in the victory of my ascension, like the king of the night, peering down at the gathered throng, the happy Halloweening citizens of Lemon. I would have my supper, and then off along the paths I'd race, to be there just in time to join in the great observation of the Bald Ridge. I reached out for the cheese sandwich, set on the plate before me on the flat rock, and drew the flask from my pocket. I felt so lucky to have remembered these snacks, and not only to have the food, but to be able to see the festivities from this vantage in the loft. A bell rang out from the McCaw Meadows, and the horses halted in their traces at the bottom of my view. And then there came the most curious, oceanic stillness and silence. I felt I knew what this was, but I couldn't quite place it. I looked at the flask and rubbed my thumbnail at the initials. T.W.D. Thomas Wentworth Dunn. Something was happening, and I would remember in a moment. I reached for the lamp on my head and turned it to full, and the orange light came bright and rosy all around with the falling, sweet rough scent of train tracks from the oil as it burned. And then, there he came, running down the porch steps into the middle of the field out near the horses, staggering and pointing. I heard him call up to me, and I raised my hands. "I see you, Seamus," I called. "Can you see me?" But my voice, I don't know, it was soft and drawn down against the wind at the roof of the cabin. I was so far away and so tired. This is the peace of our forgiveness, son. I heard myself shouting out over the fields. The ceiling of the cabin roof above me opened, and the stars came whipping down, and I was running along the rocky crest, with the points of the night catching along at me, like black bats exchanging me for darkness. I dashed through the forest, that I would make it back down into the dirt before he arrived. I collapsed near the burial hole, set the suit and shoes in the wooden boxes, and buried them down into the earth. I could see Seamus now, running over the bridle path, his flashlight beam like a sword of light cutting every tree. I set the flask and the old miner's headlamp on the earth for proof, and I then spilled down myself into the cool dirt and rolled across the land, with the dirt flying upward and closing my eyes and mouth as I reached out to pull the long, dark cloak of the earth around my shoulders, that when he arrived a moment hence to look, he would find only this peaceful, quiet semblance of the earth, with the miner's lamp and the flask on top, troubled over here and there with the small brown hands of the scattered leaves.
Seven is seven, is 27, is 48, is 44.
44.
It was a cold night, a wicked evening, and I was trying to get a lift. The decorations of the building lights like a swollen landing strip. And then conceiving, I found some leaves that I wanted, pressed and tried. The hands wouldn't let me work that night, I decided not to try. I went to Bright Street, I went in bare feet, I went to Barron's, shoes and ties. There were streamers up, they won't let you browse, hence I lied.
77 is 27, is 48, is 44. 77 is 27, is 48, is 44.
44.
The wooden ceilings, the broken windows, the curtains drawn and torn. These old motels like sunken ships still crashing on the shore. There's a bird in the deep footprint in the snow outside the door. I'd feed her if the shoe'd been mine. At Barron's I was declined. So I'm holed up for the winter in this broken down motel. I wrote to Cat to catch her up. Yes, I wrote, I'm well. There's a song of the fair traveller who rambles free and wide. I'm just like that, I wrote to Cat. Hence I lied.
77 is 27, is 48, is 44. 77 is 27, is 48, is 44.
44.
You've been listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. For more information on the show and the songs, please visit my website at radioghost.com. I'm Sherwin Sleeves. Tune in next Friday at 5 p.m. for more stories and music. Thank you, my friends.